Just before we broke for lunch, there were some vocabulary questions. So I'd like to go over them once more for clarity. In the canon, they talk about doing concentration or doing jhana. The word for concentration is samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I. And to do those, you have to develop two qualities, insight and tranquility. And as the concentration gets more developed, you'll be able to develop the tranquility further and the insight further. In the commentaries, they divide things up differently. The practice of samadhi is the same thing as tranquility or samatha. Vipassana is a discernment practice. And the commentary actually divides them into two practices. You're either doing samatha or you're doing vipassana. So what we're talking about today is looking at things the way the Buddha looked at or describes them in the canon and see if, how you can find that helpful for your own practice. One other issue that came up this morning that someone noted to me that I probably should go into a little more detail was the whole thing about not self. Because I noted that the Buddha never said there is no self, and apparently some people said, what? The one time he was asked whether there is or is not a self, he refused to answer. He said that either way you answer that question is going to give rise to wrong view. He had a whole list of questions that he would put aside as not being conducive to ending suffering, and that was one of them. Now he does talk an awful lot about not self, but he talks a lot about self as well. As we said, he talks about developing a sense of self that basically says, I'm practicing, and if I were to abandon the practice, would I really be loving myself? And he calls this having yourself as your governing principle. Yesterday we saw mindfulness as a governing principle. Here is yourself as a governing principle. There are also passages where he talks about depending on yourself, relying on yourself, having yourself as your own mainstay. But then he talks about not self, seeing the five aggregates as not self, seeing the six sense spheres as not self. So the question is, what's going on here? And I think the best way to answer that is just to notice how the Buddha talks about self as a kind of karma, that you create a sense of self around things. You make an assumption about self. You perceive self in certain things. This is an action you do. And the question then becomes, if it's an action, when is it skillful, when is it not? And there are times when you have certain selves, and this is where the image of the committee comes in useful, that you really want to let go very early on. And there are others that you're not really going to abandon until the end. Because the sense of self is centered around this, the question of how to find happiness, who's going to, and there's a self that will receive the happiness or experience the happiness, and there's a self will be able to produce it. Now, when you reach nirvana, there's nobody has to experience that, and there's nothing that nobody has to produce that. So the sense of self, at that point, it becomes unnecessary. And you get to the kind of the edge of that, and you realize, I've got to drop all sense of self. No more sense of my being in control or my experiencing this. And then that enables you to experience a deathless. And then once you've had that experience, and as my teacher once, Ajahn Sawat once said, you don't care whether this is self or not to experience, you just have the experience. So that at that point, the question becomes irrelevant. Any questions on either of those issues before we proceed? Yes?
Just to complicate the vocabulary question a bit more, can you make a bit more precise for me the distinction between samadhi as concentration and jhana as a...
Okay, samadhi can be just about any kind of concentration on anything. Now, with the four jhanas, you're concentrated specifically in what's called right concentration, and you have to be concentration that's not involved with sensuality, not involved with any of the unskillful qualities. So samadhi can be all kinds of stuff. I mean, you can be really concentrated in your anger, or really concentrated on, getting back at somebody. That would also count as concentration, but it would not be right concentration. Yeah.
Would that be an incorrect use of samadhi?
You could call it samadhi. Yeah. You're focused on something. It's been a long time since I've been watching TV. I don't know what people's skills are.
So samadhi in itself is neither
good nor bad.
Nor,
mm-hmm. Okay. And again, the word jhana in some cases also has a, you can be totally absorbed. And that usually, jhana usually goes is translated as absorption. And again, you can be totally absorbed in a video game. Now, whether we call that jhana or not, but it's not right concentration. That's the important thing. But when the Buddha does talk about concentration, it is as part of the path. It would be the four jhanas. There are four formless states that arise on top of those jhanas. Say, you know, when you get in, well, like we described the fourth jhana yesterday, and everything is very still. The breath energy is filling the body. The in and out breath is stopped. And at that point, if you stay there long enough, you begin to realize that kind of the edges of your awareness of your body begin to dissolve. And it's like you have lots of little sensation dots, like a cloud of water droplets. And instead of focusing on the water droplets, you focus on the space in between them. And that will take you to the first formless attainment. You realize, okay, that sense of space is not inhibited by anything. And then the next question is, after you've settled in there for a long time, the question arises, well, who's aware of this? And you just, it's not so much a who, but just there's consciousness, aware of the space. So you focus on the perception of consciousness being unlimited. And then you let go of the oneness of the consciousness, and that gets you into nothingness. And there's just a sense of nothing, nothing, nothing. And then there's a state that's called neither perception and non-perception, where you've dropped that particular perception, and then you go into a state of concentration that you recognize, but you don't have a specific label for it. As soon as you label it, you're out. But you do recognize it. Those are four formless attainments that build on top of the fourth jhana. And it is possible, we'll be seeing later, as you can develop insight based on any of those as well. But it gets very refined. So that's jhana, yes.
Did I hear you say yesterday that you're writing an article on something beyond the formless realm of perception or non-perception?
Well, there's an issue that's come up as to whether you're in jhana, whether your ears have to fall silent or not, and that's what the article's going to be on. And I'm basically saying no. I mean, based on the evidence from the canon, the Buddha does not describe those states as having to lose sense of your senses. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. There is a ninth one. So that's called the state of the cessation of perception and feeling. And that's when there's no labeling of anything going on in the mind. And there's no feeling of pleasure or pain, neither pleasure nor pain. It's one of the formless attainments. Sometimes they have a list of eight, sometimes they have the list of nine. And there's a controversy as to when, if someone hits that ninth one, if it's whether awakening is automatic or not. Because sometimes, as they describe it in the canon, people will awaken out of that state or gain awakening as they emerge from that state. But it's not always described that way. So that's a kind of a question mark about that one. So there are nine attainments altogether. Yeah. Yes?
My question's around end state versus gradual progression, so cultivation. So is there a
Is there a final attainment? Yes, there's nirvana. And there are four main stages, and they're kind of like quantum drops in terms of the fetters that are let go and the amount of suffering in the mind, suffering or stress.
That's a different no way back, or is
yesterday? No way back. You want to come back? No. No, once you've hit there, there's no rebirth. There's no return. Especially if, once you've hit the final attainment, there's no return. Now, the other ones are defined in the number of times you might return to life after. But the final one is, okay, you're out of the cycle entirely. And the word for that, nirvana, actually means unbinding, in the sense that they had this view that fire, when it was burning in those days, was clinging to its fuel. And then when it stopped clinging, the fire would go out and the fire was released. And they didn't talk about where the fire went or what happened. It was just it was released. Just like we say, the fire went out. Did it go outdoors? Did it go away? No. But they did have the sense that the image here is that the reason the fire is stuck on the fuel is because it's clinging. and it's agitated as a result of its clinging. Now, when it lets go, it is freed. It's not like the fuel is clinging to the fire is clinging to the fuel, in the same way that the mind clings to things. When the mind learns to let go, that's when it's freed. And there's a state of calm, and there's kind of a limitless quality to it. Kind of, yeah, there's not just kind of, very limitless. The Buddha never answered that question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He said there's a process that happens, and you can see the process in your mind, and you can put an end to the process. And that's all that needs to, that's all you really need to know. Because as for what... Well, there's the word identity, but that's, again, that's an action you do. You identify with certain things and create an identity out of that. And as you... You know, one of the things you let go of totally is this process of creating an identity at the end. Yes?
Can you explain the difference between visions and dreams?
Visions and dreams are very close. And they tend to come out of this midway state of concentration. We talked yesterday about, you know, momentary concentration, access, fixed penetration. Most of the visions will happen during the access concentration. And they're about as reliable as dreams. In other words, once in a long, 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 long while, something comes up that will be accurate. That'll actually tell you something. But a lot of it's, you have to sort through so much garbage that it's not worth it. Okay. Yes? Which ones do you want? the whole slew. That is something. It really depends on each individual's karma whether these things will happen or not. And the description in the canon is: you develop the mind to a certain state, and then if there is an opening, you develop these other powers. And some people have the opening, and for some people the opening just doesn't appear. And in some cases, you have the choice. If you want to go there, you can, but do you really want to go? And I've talked to a couple of meditators for whom that opening actually happened, and they finally decided no. And one, it was because he had said, look, I've probably been reborn as many times as I really need to. I don't need to go there and create the karma around that again, which is a potential. You can create some karma around there, you know, if you're not careful. And the other person was an older woman I knew, and she had this vision where this man appeared to her one day and said, okay, if you can memorize this list of words, you will be able to read other people's minds. And she looked at the list of words and she said, that's an awfully long list of words. It's not worth it. So, you had a question? Well, here he's talking about developing jhana. We'll find a passage later on where the same requisites are used for someone who wants to develop insight. That you go and look for quiet, isolated places to stay. And that's a shorthand for all the quiet, isolated places you can go to. Yes.
Insight and vision, aren't they
not
be the same?
No, insight here is when you're actually seeing into the way in which you've been causing yourself suffering through the process of fabrication. And visions can be with regard to almost anything. Yes.
Notice some pattern for myself that when I start to develop certain virtuous qualities or I'm noticing a change in my own thoughts process, that my dreams can become quite disturbing or violent, and I'm quite surprised that I'm having such a contrast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in the canon about that experience being typical or common?
Well, it's not in the canon, but it's typical. Partly it's struggling with itself, and partly it was, and once you've cleared off a lot of the garbage at the, on the top level of the pool, then those other stuff in the lower levels of the pool just start coming up, you know. Yes. Yes, they are. Those are sutta references. And the code is, you've got the four Nikayas. DN is the Dika Nikaya, D-I-G-H-A. MN is the Majjhima Nikaya, M-A-J-J-H-I-M-A. Okay. SN is the Sangyutta Nikaya, S-A-M-Y-U-T-T-A. And A-N is Anguttara Nikaya, A-N-G-U-T-T-A-R-A. And we may have some Udanas and Itiwutikas in here too. Those are shorter passages that come from a collection called the Kudaka Nikaya. I-T-I is Itiwutika. And U-D is Udana, U-D-A-N-A. These are all available on Access to Insight, and we're hoping to make them more updated, more up-to-date translations available on Dhamma Talks. Okay, let's look at some of these passages here. Here's Ananda talking about, whoever, monk or nun, declares his or her attainment of arahantship in my presence, they all do it by means of one another four paths. Which four? There's a case where you develop insight preceded by tranquility. As you develop insight preceded by tranquility, the path is born. You follow that path, develop it, pursue it. As you follow, develop, and pursuing it, your fetters are abandoned, your obsessions destroyed. Or you can have it with tranquility preceded by insight, or you can have tranquility in tandem with insight. And then there's this last one, which is still kind of problematic at what it means. There's a case where a monk's mind has its restlessness concerning the Dhamma well under control. Now, the commentary identifies this as with what are called the corruptions of insight. They're basically states you get into when you think you're awakened, but you're not really. But you, boy, do you believe it. And you have to get past. And getting past is either beginning to realize for yourself, that, oh, there's this, these fetters I thought I'd abandoned really aren't. Or someone can say something to you that you actually listen to. Now, the problem is people in this state don't really listen to anybody else very much. There are only select few that they will listen to. My teacher tells us the story of a couple of famous ajahns who later did actually become awakened, but they actually, prior to that, had a period of when they went through this false awakening kind of state. And they went back to see Ajahn Mun to report their new attainments. And Ajahn Mun didn't say anything. Just said, just stay around here for a couple of days. And as my teacher said, you know, just staying in Ajahn Mun's presence was enough to make them realize, oh, it's not. And the day Ajahn Phurong told this to me, we had a case of this a retired soldier who apparently had killed quite a few people in the Korean War. And after he came back from the war, he got religion. He decided, I want to make sure I don't have to suffer from that karma. So he started meditating very earnestly. And he ended up building a little hut in the monastery and coming out and meditating there. And there's one time when Ajahn Phurong was away, and I was the only monk there at the monastery. He came down from his hut and he said, last night it was great, it was this. And he had some technical term for what this attainment was. And I said, that's really nice, but I have to have my meal right now, so thank you, and left. And 2 days later, I said, one more step and it's stream entry. And so I said, that's nice to know. Yeah. And so John Fuang finally came back from Bangkok. And so he asked me, you know, what was going on in the monastery. And I said, well, Chode, that was the name of the soldier, who seems to be going off the deep end. And and he says, you didn't say anything to correct him, did you? I said, no. I said, that's good, because if he doesn't have 100% faith in you, he's not going to listen, and you actually get the person more entrenched by telling them they're not awakened. And so he told me the story about the monks who would come and see Ajahn Mun, and Ajahn Mun didn't have to say anything. Just, we were around him, and that was enough to sort of cure them of that, their problem. And just as he finished telling that story, Chode came running up the steps to report his new attainment. I think he probably heard that last sentence. And he bowed down to my teacher and said, I've been a fool for the past week. I said, oh, that's how it has to be, you know. So when you get these things under control, then your mind finally settles down, and then the path can be born. So in both cases, in all these cases, you have to develop tranquility and insight. The question is, which comes first? Or whether you can get them to come together. In a few minutes, we'll be looking at a meditation technique where the Buddha talks about how you bring them together. The next passage, though, talks about how what to do. Okay, there's a case of the individual who has attained internal tranquility of awareness, but not insight into phenomena through heightened discernment. In other words, has tranquility, but no insight. There's a case who has attained insight, but no tranquility. There's a case who has attained neither. And there's the case of the person who has both. Okay. What's interesting here is the questions that you should ask. And this is where tranquility and insight actually differ, is they're qualities of mind, but they're developed by asking and trying to answer different questions. And basically what it comes down to is if you have attained tranquility but not insight, well, first, if you haven't attained tranquility, the questions are, how should the mind be steadied? How should it be made to settle down? How should it be unified? How should it be concentrated? You're bringing the mind into oneness and stillness in a strong foundation. And so those are the questions you're pursuing as you're, say, staying with your breath or staying with whatever the object is. So, for instance, if you're staying with metta, okay, metta after a while becomes kind of long, thinking about all those beings. And say, how can I pare this down so I don't have to think about every single being in the world? And you just say, okay, just think of beings in general, and then make it kind of a more homogenous concept. And then from there, say, okay, just drop the concept of all those phrases that you may have been taught to say, and just say, okay, just goodwill, goodwill, goodwill. Try to boil it down so there's less activity in the mind. That would be practicing metta for the purpose of unifying the mind. Similarly with the breath. Okay, how do we get the breath adjusted so it feels really good so I can plunk down and stay with the breath? Those are the questions you're asking as you're trying to develop more tranquility. The questions you're trying to develop for developing insight are, how should fabrications be regarded? How should they be investigated? And how should they be seen with insight? In other words, you're looking at what's going on as fabrications. These are just sankharas happening in the mind. And they can be skillful and they can be unskillful. And so how do you look at them in such a way as to see through them? And then the question, how do you investigate them? And they can be investigated by adjusting the sankharas. They can be investigated by saying, okay, what is there in here that I am holding on to? What is there anything worthwhile holding on to in here? And then the question is, okay, how do you develop dispassion for them out of that? So basically the two qualities are developed by answering different kinds of questions. The questions for tranquility are phrased in terms of getting the mind unified, centered, concentrated. The questions for insight have to do with seeing things as fabrications, bodily fabrications, verbal or mental fabrications. Okay. Then finally, at the very end, it says, as for the individual who has attained both internal tranquility of awareness and insight into phenomena through heightened discernment, your duty is to make an effort in establishing those very same skillful qualities to a higher degree for the ending of the metal affluence or the asavas. So once you've got the two of them working together, then you just work on developing them both for the same purpose of getting rid of the what they call the asavas. Asavas here are sensuality, becoming, and ignorance. Sensuality, as we said yesterday, is your fascination with thinking sensual thoughts, of planning tonight's meal. You could be sitting here all afternoon thinking about tonight's meal. I don't recommend it, but it's a possibility. The actual eating of the meal takes, what, 20 minutes? And then you can think about it for a couple of days afterwards, if it was that good a meal. That's sensuality. It's your fascination with that kind of thinking. Becoming is taking on an identity in a particular world of experience. And that can be either a mental world or the physical world. These are all called becoming. The word is bhava in Pali, B-H-A-V-A. And I'll give you an example. And this is where the committee members of the mind come from. You have a desire. Let's say they're olives. And you know they have olives down at the fig restaurant. Okay. And you start thinking about, how do I get down to the fig restaurant? And so you have identified yourself as an olive desirer and an olive obtainer. And the world that's relevant to the olives is the places where you can get olives and the things that get in the way of your getting olives. Everything else is irrelevant at that moment. That's a becoming. You've got this particular desire, and there's a world out there that has this possibility, and you're trying to figure out how you can act within that world in order to gain that possibility. So that's becoming. And the same thing goes for chocolate. Coffee, yes. Coffee is super becoming, guys. Right? Of course, there are not many obstacles to coffee anymore, are there?
Isn't it wonderful?
Yes. I think I told you, was I telling you the story yesterday about the deva and his friend from a former lifetime? No, this is, devas, Indras have green faces, right? So this one guy gets reborn as an Indra. And he's looking around for his friend, who is also hoping to become reborn as a deva, and couldn't find him. So he looks around, finally finds him as a little worm down in a cesspool under an outhouse. And the friend comes, the deva comes down and says, "What are you doing here?" And the worm says, "I'm in heaven." See my green face? Food comes falling out of the sky. There's more than I can eat.
Point taken.
Point taken, yes. Okay, that too is a becoming. Now, becoming can happen both, as I said, on a psychological level and on the actual physical level of inhabiting this world. It's how you come into this world. It starts as a mental becoming. You probably saw a vision of the human world and the possibility of going there, and you went for it. Now you're here as a human being. You've got this becoming that you've attained. Now, as things go through your mind, desires go through your mind, you will take on other levels of becoming as well. And it's those mental becomings that would lead to your next lifetime. And so one of the things you want to put an end to is that process of becoming. Of course, that means where the becomings come from. They come from these specific desires you have. So wouldn't it be fun to be born in late 20th century North America? What kind of lifetime would that be? And you went for it. And who knows what you're going to go for this next time. You've got to train your committee really well here. So that those, and then ignorance is the last of the effluence. So those are the effluence that are abandoned with full awakening. Any questions on that passage? Yes.
Earlier on, I think you said you see phenomena as fabrications. Would it be the same as saying seeing different phenomena as being empty?
Well, empty is this quality of there being no essence to them. At least that's the Mahayana take on empty. Theravada has two different ways of looking at emptiness. One is it's empty of self. I mean, it's nothing there that's really you or yours. Here we're looking more into the process of what are you doing to create this experience to begin with? These things are not just kind of floating by. We've talked about earlier about how your experience of the present moment is a combination of past karma and present karma. We're trying to see that present karma element because that's the fabrication.
So it's kind of connected to becoming aware of an action.
The action that you're putting in, and also what's the motivation? Why are you going for this? And a lot of it is this fear. If you had this one experience and you're afraid the next moment's not going to come, so you keep on creating more next moments. And it's that kind of hunger driven by fear that keeps you focusing here, focusing there, creating new becomings, entering into them. And you want to learn how to see that process and to see what's driving it. That's how you develop dispassion. Because you're still, we talked about the mind feeding yesterday. This is a process of feeding. You're looking for things to feed on. And you have to, one, feed the mind in a better way so that it's not so hungry for the scraps on the side of the road. And then secondly, to see, is it possible not to even be driven for any kind of feeding at all? And then once you develop dispassion for all the things that you could be feeding on, that's one way that you stop the production. You know, it's as long as you see that, you know, human food is a good thing. You will fix human food every night. Then when you finally decide, look, I've had enough human food, there must be something better.
Yeah. Just an additional question, this is like a practice question. So just over the course of this weekend, you know, watching the mind, and for me I've noticed, you know, first there was the sleepiness, and I was able to eventually overcome that. And a little bit of peacefulness, but then soon after, irritability. Mm-hmm. And then, I guess over lunch, I had an opportunity to sort of rest, and the rest felt refreshing. And now I feel more here, more alert, whatever. I guess just comment on is that correct practice?
Yeah, as long as you do have to refresh the mind one way or another, but the best way is if you can get it to just settle in with the breath. So then you can kind of carry your snack around with you all the time. So if you find yourself getting a little irritable, you can come out and chew on your breath a bit. And then you're more sustained. Because if the mind doesn't get fed, it's going to, you know, fed properly, it's going to go sneaking out, getting some McDonald's.